Working Cows Podcast, Episode 103.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast. We have another episode for you guys. Really excited to be joined today by Nicole Masters. She is a soil health consultant traveling all around and, from what I understand, permanently in the United States, making the rounds and doing some consulting and some speaking. So really excited about an opportunity to sit down with Nicole Masters. Nicole, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Clay. Exciting.
So I had an opportunity to sit down with you and kind of with a bunch of other people and listen to you, and I really appreciated your teaching style and just how tangible everything was. And so I definitely, we're going to give you an opportunity to share some things that you've got coming up towards the end today, but I want to encourage people to take every opportunity they get to sit down and hear from Nicole Masters. So I started, one of the things that stuck out to me is I watched you in a soil pit talking and teaching, and everything was, you talked a lot about what the soil or what the plant community tells you about what's going on in your soil. And so could we just kind of give an overview of that, and then we'll dive in a little deeper. What are some things that can be indicated about your soil by the plant community on top of the soil?
Well, I always think of plant communities really as your fingerprints on land. And so they're fingerprints that show, you know, what historically has happened, what is current management doing, and, you know, what's happening climatically. But, you know, the communities of plant species, the dominance or the encroachment of certain types of species are telling you a lot about what's happening underground in terms of what we call the germination signals. So if you think at any one time, you know, there can be just hundreds of thousands of seeds sitting in a yard of soil, but what is it that actually turns that plant on to germinate or not? And all of that comes down to our management and climate or whatever we're doing. So there are a lot of indicators above ground. You know, people are becoming increasingly concerned with things like your cheatgrass and your Japanese broom and encroachment of, say, juniper or some of these tree species. And they are all indicating the signals. So are they biological signals? And generally they are. Or mineral signals or something to tell you that you've lost organic matter, which most ranches have, unfortunately.
What is the main cause of the loss of organic matter in most ranches as you have witnessed it?
Overgrazing is going to be obviously a big signal, but also undergrazing. So we see people think of, you know, plant roots or trees as being what's holding a soil together, but it's actually important components of your microbial community. So specifically things like fungi. So when we manage to degrade that fungal community or the activity of those different types of microbes, then soils start to lose their ability to stick or hold together. And then that means you get a wind event or you get a high rainfall event and those soils just move. And so, you know, obviously in the 30s we had huge amounts of soil losses in this country, and then right into the, you know, 70s and 80s when no-till became more popular because of the amount of soil erosion. We, you know, if you look on many ranches, they're actually effectively now ranching on subsoil, and that really happened at the turn of the last century with the overgrazing and common land management.
By the way, fingerprints on the soil, that your plant community is fingerprints on the soil, that's just one example of the kind of, I call them coat hooks that Nicole is really good at giving people to hang stuff on, and just things that you can remember, and I really appreciate that. So I wanted to dive a little bit deeper back on what you said. Are there surface level indicators that you can look at and say, this soil is healthy, this soil is unhealthy, or do you always have to dig? Do you have to get below the surface? Do you have to be in a soil pit to see? Or is there some surface level stuff you can look at and see what the soil is telling you?
Oh, absolutely. There's lots and lots of indicators above ground, but the biggest issue I see in ranching is that people aren't digging holes. And so you can pick up a lot of this stuff above ground, but the below ground stuff is going to give you some early warning signals in terms of maybe that compaction's just started or those roots are shrinking. You know, it's not uncommon to go into ranches and their roots will only be, you know, 2 or 3 inches deep, and it's like, well, how do you think you're going to access water if your rooting systems are like that? You know, there's no resilience in a ranch. If we don't have that. Obviously, bare ground is a pretty big indicator. And seeing, you know, these perched or platformed plants where they've just lost soil in between and it's just bare. People I find in ranching often think cryptogams are bad, which are the, those crusts of like lichen and mosses, and I actually like them. I just think that if you're only seeing that, obviously that's not a good sign. I was on a ranch up in the top of Montana that just had club moss, you know, and there's nothing else growing. I mean, that's pretty much telling you your water cycle is totally broken down, your decomposition cycle is broken down, water won't be entering, and you will not be building topsoil with an environment like that. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was on a ranch recently and they were covered in milk thistle, like 8 foot high milk thistle, but they're also known as variegated thistles. You know, they're really telling you that there's something seriously has gone wrong with the soil like that. Like the first time I saw it was on an operation, and they were just, milk thistle were just growing in this gully, and I said to him, you know, what's happening under the ground there? And he goes, oh, well, that's our dump, and we dumped a whole lot of batteries, and so the batteries were actually leaking, and these plants were trying to repair that battery acid. And we've seen it, not battery acid like we have nickel and cadmium and really heavy metals, but I've seen it on places where people maybe have been drenching their animals, and what happens is you'll have a sacrifice area or a field that they always go into after you drench them, or put porons on, and then those porons are all going into the ground, and then the milk thistles are coming to mop it up. And one way I like to think of soil is a little like the human body, and what we use milk thistle for in the human body is a liver detox, and it's actually doing the same thing for soil. So it's telling you that there's something has gone awry and it's trying to fix it for you. So yeah, I mean, there's so many indicators. That's just one example that you can get really excited about.
Absolutely. So you say that you are a fan of moss, and that milk thistle is like a detox for the soil, if I understood that correctly.
No, I'm not a fan of moss, but what people don't like the cryptogams.
Oh, okay.
And so they're sort of, they're told in semi-arid environments that they're a bad sign and you need to break them up. It's just at that point, that's the only thing holding your soil together. So either you're going to have a living plant there or a cryptogam. And what happens is people come in, they try and do the more mob density, and they break all that crust up, and now you've got no protection on the soil. And people often aren't aware that actually those cryptogams are not only protecting you from, you know, water and wind, but they're also they contribute to 7% of the global carbon cycle in soil. And they could be adding as much as 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre. So they are doing something of benefit. But it's like moderation is key. So it's not just having those things growing.
Right. I appreciate that clarification. Where I was going with that is, are there paradigms that you would like to challenge in that regard as far as plants that most people would say are undesirable? Are they things that we should really target, or can we abide with them living in our plant communities, or some things like that?
Well, I mean, a lot of the, I think a lot of it is changing our mindset towards what is growing. And this is what I see with regenerative agriculture, is this focus on what is the opportunity and what is it trying to tell me, instead of, oh my gosh, I have to go out there and kill it. you know, we're gonna kill all the knapweed, or we're gonna kill all the cheatgrass. Which, you know, good luck with that. But it is looking at, well, why are these species coming in? Why are they invasive? And what we're seeing now is, you could call them the new natives. And what we find is, everywhere that people go, whenever we go into a new landscape, we bring plants with us. And so this is the new wave of plant communities. And this would have changed, like, you know, 12,000 years ago, when people first came into the Americas. They brought other species and totally changed those plant succession and plant dynamics. And so we are in the middle of a new, you know, species trying to reach some kind of new equilibrium. And so we've got to be patient, but it might not happen in our lifetime, of course. So what I'm interested in is, what are those plants trying to tell us, and how can we actually help them achieve their job so that they can move on faster? And so that's where cheatgrass is quite interesting. So it's exuding different types of signals and carbon that keep soils in a very primitive state. Like, it feeds very basic bacteria and archaea, and basically halts that succession. So it makes it really challenging for more advanced, say, your perennial grasses to come in once it starts to get a foothold. And so we are working with producers in terms of changing that signal, or whatever that plant's trying to tell you, so that then the higher species can actually start to germinate.
Gotcha. I'm with you. You've touched on it a few times, but kind of this idea of quorum sensing, or within the plant and microbial community, there are certain levels of health that will tell the soil, or the soil will send out a signal to turn different things on within the soil and start to up the levels of production within a system. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Mm. Yeah, so these quorum signaling processes are kind of more recently coming to the forefront in the medical literature. So they're looking at how, you know, at any one time you might have a strep organism in your throat, but you're not virulent. And then at some point it goes virulent and now you have a sore throat. That biology's there all the time. And like, and a lot of the time, these things that we think of diseases are actually beneficial. But if they reach a certain population density and they get this signal, suddenly it turns on or it ramps up, and now we've got a disease problem. Or they switch off. So there's things that we can use to actually switch off diseases, for instance, that, you know, they're looking at in medicine. But if you think of every single little microbe, every bacteria, every single cell has about 100,000 receptors on that, outside of that membrane. And those receptors are listening for signals. They're listening for changes in temperature or water or nutrients. And so that whole biological system is just, it's always just basically sitting there and waiting for these different signals. And there are signals for them to communicate, and signals for them to communicate back to plants. And so it's quite exciting at the moment, because we really feel like we know so very little. And we've been quite arrogant, really, in terms of how we interact with our landscapes or think about landscapes, when there's so much that is yet to be uncovered. And that's what this quorum signaling is kind of raising people's awareness to, is how little of a signal is required. And we're talking parts per billion to actually turn a soil on or off. And when I drive around the US, I see a lot of soils that I would call sleepy or comatose, right? There's just no life. There's just, and you can back it up with your microbial testing and just see that there's very little switches being turned on. And so there's things that we can do, and that's where, you know, animals come in with, you know, trampling urine and manure, and how do we switch these things on, and then how do we support the plant so that it can optimally ask for what it needs. And so if a plant is signaling and saying, oh, well, I'm coming under a little bit of stress, it's been quite hot and dry, and they send a certain signal to a specific organism that says, can you provide water or a little bit of zinc or something, if that microbial community is not functional, it can't get what it needs, and then we will see a response like drought, or you'll see a response like grasshoppers. I mean, it's just been a massive year for grasshoppers everywhere I've been. Those plants are signaling to the grasshopper and saying, basically, come and clean me up. Sadly.
Right. So when I was at the conference and you were speaking, you gave a demonstration of having people come up front that represented different beneficial and non-beneficial actors within a plant and a microbial community. And you sent the people out, and I'd say this room was probably 250 or 300 people all seated around tables, just to give you some idea of the size of it. And you sent those people out with strings, and they were throwing different nutrients out. And you were saying that this is at scale of what happens in the soil of these people being this far away from that plant. If it was shrunk down to the microbial size, this would be at scale that they're pulling in those nutrients from that far away, given this the signals that are being sent out through this quorum sensing process. That was a fascinating demonstration to me. Do you have anything to say about that whole idea of what's happening and at scale under the surface, and how much maybe it's farther than we think?
Well, it certainly is further than we think, because, you know, a lot of this microbial community that we talk about does sound a little bit like pixie dust and fairy wings, you know. It's the stuff that we can't see. Because people aren't even digging holes, they don't even know what some of the basic things to look for are. And then if you think about, that piece of string was an organism called mycorrhizal fungi, which I think most ranchers are now starting to develop a familiarity with the language anyway. And so that fungus lives in and on plant roots and in and on the roots of all of our commercial plants, pretty much. So 90% of plant species have that relationship. And it can increase the surface area that a plant can reach water and nutrients by up to 10,000 times. So we're talking about a massive benefit from a plant having that relationship with that fungus, because it can stretch all the way through that room to go down and get water or to go and get a trace element. It's far further than what we were led to believe. And it's our, you know, practices like overgrazing or using herbicides or fungicides or insecticides that shed that relationship with that mycorrhizae. And now we're trying to ranch in a system where we've got two arms tied behind our backs, because we're not able to access the water or the water potential that we could. And so the biggest issue I see traveling around is not that we've got a drought issue, it's that we don't have water storage, so your carbon, and we don't have active mycorrhizal fungi going to get water. So I think that's the part of the conversation that's been missing.
Right. I think, and I'm not sure, I know it was said that weekend, but I'm not sure whose session it was said in, that, you know, it really doesn't matter how much rain you get, it's how much you keep. And the water holding capacity, which is directly tied to organic matter in the soil, is the key to holding on to more of the rain you get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the questions I got from my private Facebook group that is a little bit related to some of the things we've touched on so far is, what can we as Americans learn from what many believe to be the leading grazers in the world, that is New Zealanders, in relation to grazing management, good and bad?
Oh, dear. Well, I think, there's a bit of a mythology around New Zealand grazing. And I think if you go and visit that country, you will see that we are spectacularly good at rotational overgrazing. We have that down to an art. We're grazing species like the, ryegrass that's on a 21-day rotation. You know, so some of these guys are rotating every 14 to 21 days, which you try and imagine doing that in many of these rural contexts. I'm in big timber at the moment, looking out, sitting on the porch and going, yep, no, 14 to 21 days, I don't think so. But what you see in New Zealand really is the exemplar of what happens when we build functional carbon, organic matter, have water cycles that, they get rain, right? And they have young volcanic soil, so it's the youngest country in the world in terms of agriculture. So their current grazing methodologies are not going to be able to be sustained into the future. And what you see is that New Zealanders talk a lot more about having drought problems you know, this is the biggest drought, and they will be in a drought within 10 days. You know, of no rain, we're in a drought. And it's because if you dig holes, they only have 1 to 2 inches of roots. They're not making the most of their whole soil advantage, really. I mean, it's like they've been given the best soils in the world and they're very quickly destroying them. So the soil losses in New Zealand are catastrophic and continue to be. You know, they're losing anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000 pounds of topsoil per acre per year, I would say. And in some of their grazing management, which is the winter crop practices of just doing monocultures of brassicas, they could be losing as much as 50,000 pounds of topsoil per acre per year. So, yeah, I wouldn't go to New Zealand to learn how to graze. But I would go to New Zealand to look at what is the potential if we build, you know, vibrant organic matter and have that resource. What does that look like? Because it is quite inspiring to see that and go, well, what would my place look like if we could get the carbon back that we had, let's say in 1880, you know, when people came through these dry environments and yet found springs and found streams and found, you know, grass above the, you know, horse's horn on the saddle, you know. Where are those environments?
So are you saying that just like love covers a multitude of sins, rain covers a multitude of sins?
Oh, yeah. It does indeed. It does indeed. Well, I think carbon lets you get away with murder. Basically.
Sure. Do you think I've asked people this question before, and I'm not sure it was understood when I asked it first. Do you think that soils like that, after so much time being mined, it will take longer to regenerate them than, you know, in the way it will, the amount of time it took to mine them be dwarfed by the amount of time it takes to regenerate them, I guess is what I'm saying? Soils that have that much, or are you just always going to have that bank to draw from?
Well, let's take the example of ranches being on subsoil, because there are properties that are on subsoil. How long did it take to get there? Well, you know, maybe it's 140 years, let's say. We can certainly regenerate that a lot faster than 140 years. But it's going to take more than just grazing. And I think if you are on subsoil now, unless you've got those good monsoonal type rains, or you have those yearly where you really do get that huge amount of organic matter, it's not just a question of grazing's going to solve things. You know, and it comes back to, well, what minerals have you got sitting in that subsoil as well? So, you know, a lot of the Midwest actually does actually have beautiful minerals, right? So the minerals are sitting there. We just got to untap it, and we do that with our grazing management and, you know, diverse plant species and all the root systems and biology to get that stuff released. Yeah, I think we're seeing some pretty extraordinary results. What we do find, though, is there is a bit of a drag. You know, if you were trying to start from a system that, you know, already had good carbon levels and we are trying to regenerate that, we can get results quicker than a system that's at the bottom of the bell curve. And what we've seen in Australia anyway is just it just seems to drag a little bit, and then suddenly there's an exponential takeoff in terms of soil building and biological activity and carbon. And I think there's some good examples of this happening in the US as well. When people start to work on soil health, it just feels like they're just, you know, step by step, every year it's slightly better, and then suddenly it just goes boomfah. And so, yeah, it's always a case-by-case basis. You know, it's that piece of string question, how long, well, how degraded, and what have you got now, and, yeah.
Here's a question. It says, for somebody just starting out, what soil tests should we be doing, and how often? And I heard you talk about people who buy land without first digging a soil pit, and could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think to buy land without getting a shovel, you know, like just, you know, to dig holes in some of the different areas that you see in case you are sitting on top of something that's going to take a really long time, like you are on subsoil. If you find you've only got an inch of top, you know, like any kind of soil across that place, it's going to take you a while. I'm not to say it's impossible, but yeah, dig a hole. It's your biggest investment. You're just about to invest all this money in land, and you don't know what's hiding beneath the ground. And I've seen some pretty big train wrecks with people not digging a hole. And then the question of soil testing. Yeah, so there are some really good laboratories here in in the US. I used to send soil tests from New Zealand to the US because I liked some of your soil tests so much. And, you know, just to even just get baselines on that, it's not that you're, especially in ranching, we're not going to try and make those numbers be perfect, and you wouldn't be able to afford to do that anyway. But to baseline it, to have a look at, all right, am I moving in the right direction? So we're going to take those tests every 4 to 5 years, or am I actually degrading my resource? And maybe you want to sample more often if you have that concern. And I do a subsoil test as well. So I do a soil test just at that top 6 inches, and then sample below that to have a look at, well, what's the potential? You know, is there something down there like calcium or magnesium that would be great if we can get it up to the top. And, yeah, I always take, you know, those soil tests would be about 5% of my consideration when we're trying to work out what the next steps are, but at least it gives you some information. You know, there was a drive there for a while of, oh, don't take soil tests. No, they're not perfect, but they do give you just a general idea of what's the ballpark that we're playing in. Because I have seen some ranches in the U.S. really hit walls, you know, doing great, great grazing, but having less than 20% base saturation calcium sitting in there, and they're, after 30 years, their grazing's degrading that system, their soils are getting tighter, the biology is shut down, and they're like, well, you know, we're doing the grazing right, and biologicals won't work in those soil conditions either. So thinking of more coastal regions like the Californian coast and you know, Vermont and Maryland and all down that coast, if you have high rainfall or low calcium, that might be what's holding you up. So you just, it's just good to get an insight. Okay, all right, well, what's the potential?
Sure, very helpful. Yeah. And this was, you know, for somebody just starting out, he prefaced that question, and then the last half of his question was, will spraying herbicide negatively impact soil health?
Yes.
And is that we can find ways to manage undesirable plant communities without herbicides in every case, or what do you?
Well, I'm in the camp of you need to earn the right to be managing an operation and not require herbicides or pesticides or whatever. So we look. Nobody get offended, but we call it the methadone program, right? So we're on the methadone program. We're in a situation where we've got a lot of weed pressures, and maybe they're poisonous plants, or maybe, you know, 60% of your, oh gosh, you wouldn't want to be spraying that anyway. Or you have really invasive weeds that are causing community problems. You know, if you've got knapweed and leafy spurge heading through the neighbors out of your gullies, you know, you're not going to make friends doing things like that. So typically, I mean, I think we've got about 240,000 acres of cropping that we work with. And so we use fulvic acid. So we put fulvic acid in with our herbicides. We drop that rate by 30% in the process of doing that, so we can effectively get a kill, but we're also feeding the beneficial microbiology and we're chelating that herbicide. And so that's my methadone program. So we only do that until we've built a system that requires minimal intervention with herbicides. So a lot of my cropping guys now, they might use a small amount of a pre-emergent and they're not using post-emergence. You know, they'll barely scuff the surface if they see, you know, something that they feel is causing production losses. But, you know, in rangeland, I guess it's to look at, well, what are these species and what is encroaching in? I'm not against the herbicide, but it would be more, all right, let's do it once, let's do it well, let's put fulvic acid in with it, and then let's get our management right. Because it's your management that plant, the reason that plant's now germinating. Now, for things that are perennials, so thinking your leafy spurge or your juniper or sage, they're going to require some kind of mechanical or fire or herbicide or some kind of shock, some kind of intervention to interrupt that growing cycle, because they've already germinated now. You can't influence that germination signal, obviously. I'm not against kind of like a one-off shock and then, okay, how do we get the management working so that we don't see these continuing?
I really appreciate that answer. More on the crop side, what are the actual crop yields for grain and other food crops in no-till systems compared to conventional farming?
In regenerative, you mean?
Yeah.
My guys are all getting equivalent yields. Yeah, I'm not a big believer in, oh, you're going to drop yields. Again, it's this, you've got to earn the right. You know, it's that, can you pull this out of the, can you pull the rug out? Well, have you got systems in place so that you're not going to have a yield drop? So, I don't like saying we're going to guarantee that you're going to maintain yield, especially if people have, like, over-the-top yields because they're just pushing that system with a lot of, NPK. But we are maintaining yields, but at incredibly more profitable rates. I mean, typically on a per acre basis, we're dropping spend by, $100 an acre. So, these guys are making a lot more money.
Right. We're talking about, yep. And I appreciate Gabe Brown sharing the idea of profit, not yield, kind of similar to profit, not weaning weight in the cattle production side of things. You know, we're wanting profit, not yield, profit, not weaning weight. So, because that's what really matters at the end is that ability to maintain a profit. So, I got one more question. I think we're going to try and work through here if you don't mind. Is it possible to sequester as much carbon as some people say when we're still focused on producing grain for human consumption? And I think the question is about the fact that there doesn't seem to be enough of a gap between the grain production and the cover crop for the animal to get out on the soil. I guess maybe some strategies in that regard to open up those fields that are being used for human grain consumption to be impacted by animals.
Oh, I see. So there's not enough animals to do that?
Not enough a gap between the crop for human consumption and then a cover crop going back in or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting watching, cover crops all around the country and, into Canada and, we're working in Australia and New Zealand and just seeing that dynamic really of that goal of wanting animals to get across every acre and the reality of, let's say you're 24,000 acres, are you realistically going to be able to get animals across that in a short growing season? Probably not. There's a couple of different pieces that you kind of alluded to, and one of them is can we sequester carbon in cropping areas that are growing food?
Right.
Absolutely. Part of how can we get animals out there might be things like your compost extracts, using manures to build some of these inoculants so that even if you can't get animals across, at least you're getting an inoculant across. I think you can look at what the dollar value is of putting cover crops in, for instance, for overcoming soil limitations and going, well, actually we can justify taking 10% of the crop out to put in a cover crop and then feed back to animals and, do the numbers on something like that. My concern has been the pretty high amount of cover crop failure that I'm seeing. And these are guys that are doing a really great job. Like, they're not overgrazing. They're not, they're getting their timings right, but maybe they're just not getting germination moisture. And on crops where they're following perhaps from things like canola, where you've got soils that are really compacted and in really poor biological shape, seeing cover crop failures after following on canola. So just thinking about what do I need to do to support a cover crop so that we don't have failures, because it's not cheap.
right.
Yeah. But, and I think if we're talking about growing human food, a lot of what's been grown out there is not for humans, unless you say, well, it's going to the cow and then it's going to the human. But thanks to biofuel, I think they're showing that maybe the future's not going to be in those bioethanols. And personally, coming from New Zealand, where we don't really have feedlots, it's a hard one for me to get my head around. I mean, yeah, it just seems like there's a lot of land that's not being used as well as it could do. I mean, I think if we think about how much land is effectively being grazed, our grazing inefficiencies on rangeland are really poor. And in part, it's because of infrastructure or water or whatever. But yeah, animals really aren't. We're not sitting at capacity of potential for the American West.
Right. We started off by talking about what is your plant community telling you, and I didn't really make it back around to what do we do in response. And I guess specifically for the Working Cows podcast, what are we, how can we manage our animals in a way? What are some things that we can do to respond correctly to what the signals we're receiving from our plant communities?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's the basic principles, you know, making sure that you do have ground cover, that you are trampling, not taking too much of that plant back, allowing adequate rest and recovery, and then grazing at different times of the year, because you're trampling different types of foods for microbiology. So early in the season, when we've got good moisture, most of what you're trampling actually feeds bacteria. Then as we come later into the season and maybe you've got taller pastures or, you know, things have browned off, if you're trampling that, then that's going to be feeding more of our beneficial fungi. So there's different types of microbes that feed on different types of foods. So this is, you know, it's part of good grazing management anyway. I'm not going to graze the same field in July every year, or I'm not going to just calve in this area every year, because you're going to degrade not only above ground but below ground, you know, and the more diversity we have below ground, then the more diversity we're going to see above ground. And so grazing for different types of species and just making sure we're not taking those plants right back, because plants will really look after themselves. You know, if you take them right down, they're not going to be feeding microbiology in that process. They've got to store sugars for themselves so that they can regrow. And so if you take it down, like if you take 90% of the plant, for instance, they just stop producing any sugar. They stop producing those signals, all the foods for microbes. So your whole system just stalls, and we can't afford to ever do that, really. Unless you were trying to intentionally do that because you're wanting to put in another crop or direct drill or something. I'm a massive fan of putting seeds in my mineral. And we are seeing some really cool stuff here in Montana with, just some species that you read in the literature are really hard to strike, are really hard to establish. And, we're just seeing some cool stuff. And so we're doing a pound an acre of, just the ranch I'm here at the moment, they're doing 70 different species are going into that mineral and then going out onto the rangeland. And we're seeing some just really tasty, high performing species coming through.
Very good. So this next question, I know I said I'm two questions deep after I said my last question, but This is the last one. Then we're going to give you a chance to share some things you've got coming up. But and this next question might be the fact that it's a Canadian asking a question of a New Zealander with a dumb American trying to translate. So I'm not sure. We'll give it a shot. It says, are commercial eco tea mixes as good as homegrown tea blends? Now, I don't know if that's like tea you drink or compost tea. I'm not sure what's being asked.
They're talking compost tea.
Okay, that's what I thought. That's what I thought too.
depends. You know, are you really good at making compost? Are you really, you know, have you got some areas that you know are really vibrant and alive and diverse, and are you testing it? You know, some of those packaged products are pretty good, I would rather make things from my own native biology and be, you know, using stuff that I'm going to collect from underneath maybe some aspen forest or a place where the grasses are really good. But the thing is, I find most people don't know how to use a microscope adequately to really be able to have a look and go, all right, I know I'm making a good brew. So there's just a few things that can go wrong. I personally don't make teas anymore. I just think that there's too many things that can go wrong as well. So we just do extracts. So we get a good enough, you know, like it's the best quality vermicast and compost that we can, and then make liquid extracts off that. And that's what we're using on rangeland and seeing some really fantastic results with. And that's all being made on farm or on ranch. I'm sure there's some good packaged products out there. And what you find is the biology, you know, microbes all are traveling in the atmosphere. I mean, they're traveling in rain. The species aren't necessarily massively different, but you do get local native, acclimatized kind of species. So, you know, if you can work with your local microbes, then that's going to be better, personally.
Sure. And what's the difference between an extract and a tea, I guess? I'll throw that one out there.
So a tea is something that you're actually bubbling away for, and it might be for 24 hours or 3 days, and you put in your inoculant and then you feed it, and then you keep brewing it, aerating it. But what you find is mostly what breeds up in those cycles is a lot of bacteria, and it's going to be very specific to what the foods are that you put in. Whereas an extract, you use more compost, like maybe you use a couple of cups in a tea brewer, but you might use a bucket, just for comparison, let's say. And then you're just going to put water through it. So we have slurry machines that I really encourage anyone that works with me ends up making one, so that we can spray materials up to, you know, a fifth of an inch in size, so that we can spray seed out, we can put compost out, we can put minerals out if we want to, you know, we can put everything out as a liquid and not have to worry about things blocking. So, yeah, I love those. And so, yeah, just it's really simple. There's no brewing, there's no waiting. As long as you know that the compost or vermicast is good, then you're good to go.
So along the lines of letting you share what you've got coming up, where can people get in touch with you? And on those venues, is there a place where they could see a slurry machine that you have recommend they build or get a handle on?
The company that I've been working with in New Zealand is called chaossprings.co.nz, so NZ for New Zealand. And he has pages of all the different types of machines that they've been making. I often share things on, like, you know, Instagram or Facebook or whatever when, you know, you come across a cool sprayer. And I do talk about these things. So I've got quite a few workshops. Well, I've got a couple of workshops coming up. I've got one in, what month are we now? August. Yeah. Mm-hmm. September. I've got a one in Saskatchewan on the 23rd, 24th, and then 26th, 27th in BC. So I'm in Canada. And then in October, I've got a workshop in Montana with Abe Collins. So I'm super excited about that. That'll be the 23rd of October in Billings, Montana. And then, a two-day workshop in Texas, also in October.
Very good.
And then I will be on a book tour. So the book's coming out on the 15th of October. It's called The Regenerators. People can pre-order now. My website's integritysoils.co.nz. I'll be book touring. So if anyone thinks, my local town would be a great place to come and do like a book reading, then I'll be on the road.
Very good. Yeah, and I will link to all that at workingcows.net/103. You can find links to everything that we just talked about, the upcoming workshops and the book tour and the book pre-sales and all that. So, Nicole, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, appreciate it, Clay. Thank you. Brilliant. Happy growing.
Coming up next week on the show, we are trying to coordinate things together to have Graham Reese of the KLR Marketing School in Australia. And so we're all accents all the time here on the Working Cows podcast for a little bit. Really excited about the networking opportunity that was afforded to me by the Ranching for Generations conference. I thank Dave Pratt and Dallas Mount for allowing me to be a part of that and spend the day on the Padlock Ranch with them. Very good stuff. So look forward to another episode as soon as possible early next week with Graham Reese of KLR Marketing from Australia. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week. We'll